Lately. There, you did it. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. Here in Philadelphia, we have two weekly meetings. This Wednesday evening study class, where we're studying the ocean of theosophy. We're in the final chapters, studying psychic forces and phenomena. And next Wednesday, we'll be starting chapter 17. And then the Wednesday after that, the 20th, we will have a special commemoration, ULT Day, celebrating the life and work of Robert Crosby and the life and future of the United Lodge. Those meetings are from 7:30 to 8:30, and preceding them is a reference library from 5:15 to 7:15. And then on Sunday mornings, our building opens at 10:30. We have a lecture or a panel or a shorter talk from 11 to 12. And the title for this coming Sunday, we think everyone has to be here, Seize the Day, Fashion Tomorrow. I don't think anyone can resist. The work done at this lodge or any lodge is on the basis of voluntary donation of time, of service, and of money. And all are needed, all are appreciated. If you want to make a donation, you may do so at the book table or in the little box on the bookcases as you exit the building. Everyone, of course, is welcome to attend and welcome to participate.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. There you go. Okay, this evening, what we're going to do, it's a very short part, and we're going to read it in segments. We'll read a paragraph or two, and then have a little discussion, and then we'll go along in that manner, and perhaps we'll finish the part. So we are finishing up the penultimate chapter of The Ocean of Theosophy. And we are starting on page 143, the last paragraph. Dreams are sometimes the result. And our first reader is going to go and finish that paragraph on page 144.
Dreams are sometimes the result of brain action automatically perceived, and are also produced by the transmission into the brain by the real inner person of those scenes or ideas, high or low, which that new person has seen while the body slept. They are then strained into the brain as a floating on the soul as it sinks into the body. These dreams may be of use, but generally the resumption of bodily activity destroys the meaning, perverts the image, and reduces all to confusion. But the great fact of all dreaming is that someone perceives and feels their image. And this is one of the arguments for the inner person's existence. In sleep, the inner man communes with higher intelligences, and sometimes succeeds in impressing the brain with what is gained. Either a high idea or a prophetic vision, or else fails in consequence of the resistance of brain fiber. The karma of the person also determines the meaning of the dream. For a king may dream that which relates to his kingdom, while the same thing dreamed by a citizen relates to nothing of temporal consequence. But as said by Job, in dreams and visions of the night, man is instructed.
You know, I think we're going to go with the second reading now, too. Then we'll take a break in the middle and do the third and fourth readings. So, second reading.
Apparitions and doubles are of two classes. The one, astral shells or images from the astral world, either actually visible to the eye or the result of vibration within thrown out to the eye and thus making a person think he sees an objective form without. The other, the astral body of living persons and carrying full consciousness or only partially so endowed. Laborious attempts by psychical research societies to prove apparitions without knowing these laws really prove nothing, for out of 20 admitted cases, 19 may be the objectification of the image impressed on the brain. But that apparitions have been seen, there is no doubt. Apparitions of those just dead may be either pictures made objective as described, or the astral body, called Kamarupa at this stage, of the deceased. And as the dying thoughts and forces released from the body are very strong, we have more accounts of such apparitions than of any other class. The adept may send out his apparition, which, however, is called by another name, as it consists of his conscious and trained astral body endowed with all his intelligence and not wholly detached from his physical brain.
So we're going to open it up for discussion now. It's interesting that there's just one paragraph on specifically relating to dreams thrown in there, but it's there's a whole section in Transactions on Dreams, Transactions of the Blavatsky Lodge, which is very instructive because it gives much more detail, goes into the various forms of dreams. So we're talking about higher intelligences, brain fiber, how the karma of the person determines the meaning of the dream. The example is given of the like a king or a queen, a ruler, or we would say a president, could have a dream, and it would have to do about this country. Just, well, like Lincoln dreamed about his own death, and it would have, you know, but for someone who doesn't hold such a position, it may just, we probably have to, you know, really dig a little deeper. And it is good to keep a dream journal, and because it's a different language. It's truly a different language. And we need to learn how to translate. So, yes.
Well, although the transaction material is wonderful and informative and illuminating, we think this one part of one sentence is the most, I don't know, inspiring. In sleep, the inner man communes with higher intelligences. Now, if that isn't a good goal to find out what those experiences are and bring them back with us.
Yes. Even the criminal, even the worst criminal, during deep sleep is one with all. Yeah, you had your hand up.
Well, further, it was mentioned that it's in deep sleep that the inner man, the dreamless sleep.
Right.
So who or what are these higher intelligences that the inner man communicates with? Is that other souls or what does that mean?
Well, you know, it's, we personally have never read exactly which higher intelligences they are, but we're just thinking that it's the highest of all intelligences, which would be adepts and masters. Yeah.
We would think in addition to that, there are normal human beings functioning on this planet that are higher intelligences. They spend more time in the spiritual functioning of life than most of us do. So we think there's gradations up to the highest, the mnemonic highest, and down to maybe scientists and authors and artists. We think it's our karma and our need that pulls us to a certain intelligence.
Yes.
But isn't there a part of our intelligence? Is there a part of the every human being's intelligence that is higher on the spiritual plane than what we are familiar with in this waking state?
Well, our higher self, we've been impressed with all the knowledge that we need, and we've covered it up with over the millions of years of creating karma, a lot of that bad karma. We've sort of lost our way, so we can access that. That all knowledge is out there.
Well, you know, he speaks of the higher intelligences, but sometimes the expression is that we commune with the gods. The gods with a small g. And we like to think of gods with a small g more as, you know, observing the forces of nature and coming to better understand the laws of nature. it's reasonable to refer to them as gods. And so perhaps we put ourselves in a position where we're able to look directly upon certain things and understand them more clearly than when we're operating through the brain. Maybe it could be something like as simple as that.
Could very well be. Yes?
But then the next step is to impress it on our brains so we have it on this plane. We may wake with a feeling of hope or joy, but we can't make it active in our life until we understand it.
So, generally speaking, when we arise, we may not remember anything, or something can happen during the day that'll trigger a dream memory, and then it'll all come back to us. And, you know, and then there's, of course, there's deja vu as well. We don't know if that's the same thing. We think that's two different things, but I guess they could be related. So dreams are, as said earlier, it's another language that we need to learn. That's why it's good to study symbolism, and it's an interesting study of symbolism, because dreams are really a series of symbols. Yes?
So when it says in that next sentence, the karma of the person also determines the meaning of the dream, does that mean that karma acts in our dreams? We receive karmically the results of our actions and dreams?
Well, karma is always operational. It is the law. There's no time when it's not operational. When we have our review at the end of our life, during those final hours when the body seems like we might not have a heartbeat, but until the last bit of heat leaves the body, we're busy in our brain, and we will remember all the dreams that we had, as well as all of the experiences we had, and everything that we missed, that we might, because we miss by being inattentive and distracted, which is, it's impossible not to be distracted in today's world. We're told we should set aside time for concentration and meditation every day, so that we, you know, so we can be more clear seeing. Clairvoyant means clear seeing, but that's as a psychic power. We can be clear. We should be as clear seeing as we can, and awake, alive, and alert to all life's experiences, and to perform every task, no matter how mundane, with our full attention. And that's a way to develop concentration.
But we think this reference to karma here has to do with the meaning of a dream. In other words, a king and a peasant could dream the exact same dream, but the meaning will relate to the karma of that individual.
Yes. The karma will, right, the karma, in a sense, karma determines dreams, but also the karma of the individual, their station in life, in this life, being born in this nation, in this family, in this time, all for a reason, for specific reasons. So we need to take all that into consideration. Do you have your hand up back there? No. Okay.
I did. Also, it seems that karma operates to set up certain skandhas, certain tendencies, and this is an inheritance that soul brings over from past lives. Those skandhas would affect our ability to use mine for this fibrous brain and the memories in those fibers itself. So what practices would we set up to try to make this brain more porous, or are things as what we eat and what we read and what we listen to, do those things influence the fibers of the brain and what can be brought back from the brain state?
Well, that's an interesting study because, you know, we're told that being a vegetarian does not necessarily make you doesn't make you any more spiritual than a meat eater. That spirituality doesn't come from meat, but or from vegetables. It's just it doesn't. But yet, if when we're eating, we think about you know everything that went into that, all the sacrifices that were made on down the line from the sowing of the seed to the reaping of the harvest to the processing, the transportation, those who stock the shelves in the market, just to be have an attitude of gratitude at all times for, you know, that we are, I mean, you know, that we are fed. Just be grateful for that. Yes.
And it's such a great example of brotherhood. It's how people are earning their living, but at the same time, what they're doing is providing for people they don't even know.
Right. And there's a lot of hard work that goes in there and a lot of... there's a lot of mindfulness, so we should be mindful as well. But it's not just the food; it's what thoughts we accept or reject, because we shouldn't let somebody slander another when we should stand up for those that are weaker or defenseless. Or absent when somebody is being hypercritical or slanderous, that's straight out, that can happen too. We should, you know, we need to watch our thoughts, watch what comes out of our mouth. It's less what goes in our mouth than what comes out of our mouth. That's what we really need to watch.
Since we would know that the brain is being impressed because we can remember our dreams better, would the practice during our waking hours to be more attentive, more focused, more mindful of our experiences, not just the physical ones, but also a higher intuition, just more aware, and so that our brain gets used to being impressed and remembering all of our experiences, not just the dream ones, but the waking ones as well.
Yes, we need to be aware of our environment, our physical environment, when we're walking down the street or we're driving a car. In a sense, we have to be watching out for everybody and everything, because a lot of people are not paying attention. So, by concentrating on the smallest tasks and the greatest ones as well, we're developing mindfulness. And we need to be attentive because, you know, not only watching out for our own safety, but the safety of others. Because there's so many distractions nowadays, especially, and Mr. Judge used a great saying. He talks about, you know, the senseless jog trot of just like, you know, you can get into a jog trot and your mind is not really engaged. You're on automatic pilot. But, you know, it is interesting that there's been, we think it's kind of scary, but there's a lot of cars now that have autopilot. They run on GPS. But you're supposed to still be paying attention, and you're supposed to be able to grab that wheel. But in all honesty, if somebody puts that into operation, we think most people are not paying attention. So it's dangerous to even certain technology. It's dangerous to even put forth, we think. But I mean, there haven't been many accidents. There's the case to be made that there's far less accidents than with this, a human driver. But then again, this technology is brand new, so only time will tell. Yes.
Well, we think the same rule has to apply to all of us. We are an automatic pilot, and we should wake up every so often. So we should figure out ways to wake ourselves up, not let it be some car out of control. Like sort of one eye on the world and the other eye on us and souls around us who might need help.
So does anyone have any ideas about how to wake ourselves up?
Yep.
Besides coffee?
Well, we're trying to figure out an analogy for this, and we might have it. In our solitude, when we listen to music, typically we prefer to listen to music that has no lyrics, not even instrumental lyrics, it's just that never had, you know, and it puts us into a different place than listening to music with lyrics, because the lyrics tell you what to think and how to feel, you know? So when we listen to music without lyrics, it's a different experience. So take the music away, and in our solitude, can you be in solitude and think kind of without words, like to get into just, you know, just higher thoughts, just appreciation for the sake of appreciating things, you know, gratitude for the sake of gratitude, for the sake of being grateful for what's among and around us. And that might be, you know, we hear about, oh, well, think universal thoughts. It could be that, like the less words we have rattling in our head about whatever it is we're thinking about, we think it's possible by means of analogy to this wordless experience of music.
So instrumental music or mood music, but trying to engage the imagination or reviewing the day or life circumstances, calming down. Yes?
I mean, isn't it basically a kind of meditative thing where you have all these ideas going through your head as you're doing something, so that you're not aware of what you're really doing. You're not really there, because you're here, there. It's a matter of focus, which is, I mean, it's like meditation. It's hard to imagine being in a meditative state 24 hours a day, but, I mean, it would seem that if you're in more of a meditative state where you focus on what you're doing and just learn to train your mind to not be thinking 10 things at once, and then you're living your own life. I mean, the other way, you're living it, but you don't even know. You're living it without even being aware of your own life.
Yes. Just exactly. Yes?
It's always been our understanding that the literature of the devotion, as well as the Gita, and the Course of the Silence, we have to read it. Now, once we've done the reading...
Could you speak up just a little bit louder?
Once we've done the reading, worship me only with thine eyes, and I will cleanse thee mine. Mother Nature. So after we have done our study, or even the experiences we have during the day, to our understanding, we're to look within. Questions. And dwelling upon these ideas, rather than just reading them. What comes back to me is that famous cartoon of a man with an electric light bulb flashing over his head. And the statement, "Oh, I read, I listened, now I see." So when we hear these phrases and we study the ocean, which I understand we have to think about it. And thinking is an inner. Once we know that it brings results, repeatedly, we will try.
Well, Theosophy has many grand ideas, ideals, principles, and we are to dwell on them, to meditate on them, to dwell on them, to think throughout the day. To think, I am that. We need to stay focused. We need to cultivate calmness. If we're going to be able to be as highly effective as we can. There was a hand in the middle row. You had your hand up, remember? How do we cultivate mindfulness? We're talking about mindfulness,
yeah.
Basically. Doesn't mean it that way. Sorry. That's the peanut gallery back there.
Yeah, I know. I felt a few nuts. The question was, how does one wake up? What is that? And, I don't think you can say it to any one thing. For everybody, it's different. You know, someone just speaks to you in a certain way, like they know you. If they talk to you, like they know you. And whether they know you or not, it's that familiarity that makes, I know this person. I think the realization that we're all one and how we're all connected, being here and now, and things sort of will uncover before us. So we don't really have to be searching that way, but just being honest. Trying to live moment.
Being honest and living moment to moment, very important. Bye.
There's also a walk in the woods. You don't have to have any words in your mind. You're smelling and you're seeing, and it can lift you. Or go outside and celebrate the stars. I mean, there's so many things we can do without words, just by opening our own heart. Go work in a soup kitchen. You don't need words. You feel the love between the sharing.
Yes, if we feel that interconnectedness, because universal brotherhood is not only all of humanity, but it's all of life is one. It's all connected. There is no separation except for those obstacles we put in our minds, but they're illusory. So by getting out and connecting with people or nature are the two greatest ways to get over oneself, we think. Yes?
Maybe just to take it a step further, it's not just that we want to wake up. We want to wake up to the spiritual life. one very practical way to do that is we have on our book table little pocket-sized pamphlets. We have the devotional books. Just keeping them in your pocket, and every time you have a free moment where you don't necessarily have some duty to perform, just pull it out and read it. Well, that'll wake you up, but it'll also wake you up in the right direction.
Yes, and we can feel the living power of the words, because ideas and words, especially devotional books, they're so poetic and yet so practical at the same time, and they can vivify you and inspire you. So we're going to actually read the rest of the chapter now. And so the third reading starts at the very bottom of page 144, Theosophy Does Not Deny, and to the end of that rather long paragraph in the same manner on page 145.
Theosophy does not deny nor ignore the physical law as discovered by science. It admits all such as are proven, but it asserts the existence of others which modify the action of those we ordinarily know. Behind all the visible phenomena is the occult cosmos with this ideal machinery. That occult cosmos can only be fully understood by means of the inner senses which pertain to it. Those senses will not be easily developed if their existence is denied. Brain and mind acting together have the power to evolve forms, first as astral ones and astral substance, and later as visible ones by accretions of the matter on this plane. Objectivity depends largely on perception, and perception may be affected by inner stimuli. Hence, a witness may either see an object which actually exists as such without, or may be made to see one by internal stimulus. This gives us three modes of sight. A, with the eye by means of light from an object. B, with the inner senses by means of the astral light, and C, by stimulus from within which causes the eye to report to the brain, thus throwing the inner image without. The phenomena of the other senses may be tabulated in the same manner.
And finish the next two paragraphs and finish the chapter at this time.
The astral substance being the register of all thoughts, sounds, pictures, and other vibrations, and the inner man being a complete person, able to act with or without coordination with the physical, all the phenomena of hypnotism, clairvoyance, clairaudience, mediumship, and the rest of those which are not consciously performed may be explained. In the astral substance are all sounds and pictures, and in the astral man remain impressions of every event, however remote or insignificant. These, acting together, produce the phenomena which seem so strange to those who deny or are unaware of the postulates of occultism. But to explain the phenomena performed by adepts, fakirs, yogis, and all trained occultists, one has to understand the occult laws of chemistry, of mind, of force, and of matter. These, it is obviously not the province of such a work as this to treat in detail.
So it ends with a little teaser there. We're not going to talk about it, but it's brought up, so it's in your mind. Like, how fascinating to that trained occultists need to understand the occult laws of chemistry, of mind, of force, and matter. And by reading The Secret Doctrine, especially, or Isis Unveiled, there's a lot in there. There's a lot of things that are hinted at, and they're seed ideas for us to dwell on. We may not be in an occult. We may not be occultist at this point. We think from what we understand, there are few true occultists at this point, but we really don't know. Go ahead.
Well, since, as it says above, in order to understand the occult cosmos, which we were just talking about, the inner senses need to be developed. So even if Mr. Judge did go into an explanation in the written word, that doesn't mean we will even understand it or appreciate it unless we have already developed some of these inner senses to intuitively grasp it or directly understand what we're saying. Because we all know we can read college chemistry books and physics books, they're in English, but we don't have the basic concepts down there, but we have a foreign language.
Well, we were reading about volcanology and chemistry last night, and we got lost pretty quick. But with all this all these eruptions now that are going on the earth, it's it is fascinating, and we get the general idea, but we're not a chemist, so yes. What does it mean to form the nucleus of a universal brotherhood? Well, it's actually the nucleus. We had a discussion on this earlier. It's already, in a sense, it's already there. It's, in a sense, we could say that there is a nucleus in Masonry. We could say there is a nucleus in trade unionism, or a nucleus and the American Medical Association, but we need to form the nucleus, the one that is going to spread, going to bring back the ancient wisdom religion, which is really what theosophy is. So we're trying to be the nucleus for these ancient, timeless, universal spiritual concepts that are lost in the limited nucleus of the various groups, organizations, churches, religions. There's thousands of religions in the world, and they all have truth to them, but they don't have the synthetic truth that is embodied in the wisdom religion of theosophy.
Same time, this is a pretty simple book. Anybody can read it and understand it. So in a way, it's a beginner's book. But why does it get more and more interesting to us every year for 20 years?
Yes.
Don't we understand it in different ways as the years go by? And might that have something to do with the way he wrote it, that we are growing in certain ways to understand it?
Well, it's an organic book that we can grow with. It's true, it was written as a series of newspaper articles in 1893 for the layman, but one has to be at least of average intelligence to get much out of it. It's not written on a high level as far as vocabulary goes. But there's a lot of truth that we need to read within the lines, between the lines, the words, it all has to do with our journey. It's something, it's vast. It's called the ocean of theosophy because it is vast.
So it actually might be there.
It's all in here. It's a synthesis of the secret doctrine. And so it's a synthesis. It's not, you know, of course, it is.
Well, it says here that objectivity, or those things that appear to be objective, depend largely on our perception. But that perception itself can be affected by inner stimuli. Sounds like a lot of variables. How do we know what we're seeing is real?
Well,
what does it mean for something to be real? If we're so dependent on this perception and those stimuli.
Well, reality is relative when we're in these physical bodies, we're working through astral matter, and absolute truth, absolute reality with a capital R eludes us at this stage, but we need to test, check, and verify to see if, you know, these ideas are not put forth as dogma. We do not need to believe them. There are no musts. But it's up to us to see if they're true. And they may not be true yet for us because we don't have, you know, we haven't reached that point where we can really comprehend yet. Follow up?
Well, when we were thinking about it, we recall that statement by HPB in The Secret Doctrine, where she says something to the effect that, okay, well, in the perspective of the absolute, all these things are an illusion, temporary and relative. But to the thinker in the situation, it is as real. It is the reality for them at that time.
Right.
And it's as real as they are. And all revolution is going from one perception of a reality to another. So maybe that answers part of the question is why, after reading this book 20 times or 40 times, we get more out of it. Because we see more reality, more real things in it.
And they are necessary illusions for us to learn the lesson, to be able to see that it's an illusion and move beyond it. Yes. Did you speak up? I didn't catch that last part.
The more we follow these lines as they are laid down.
Follow the lines laid down.
Text, we unknowingly perhaps awaken a negative, an opposing force within ourselves, which then tells you that there has to be an understanding of who am I, and that universal brotherhood is a fact in nature, and that we have to understand that part of our nature which is opposed to anything that is, shall we say, unselfish. That's where Arjuna comes in, when he finds out that he has these opposing forces to defeat, and Krishna encourages him. That is when we stop to think comes out of the cell is important. And how do we help to do that? By listening and thinking about it.
Well, if we are doing our best to follow the path and the lines laid down in the teachings, that there is a series of progressive awakenings. It's not for the mentally lazy or obtuse. It requires effort. But that's why when we read this again and again, we may, you know, there may be something that we don't remember seeing before, or we know we read it before, but it didn't really stand out. That's because, yes, we weren't really ready for it, but now we are.
We also change as we are applying these ideas. We're not the same person, mentally or emotionally, who started reading this book. But we wanted to say, just as there are expressed here three modes of sight, and the other senses can be used that way. A student in the past said this: there are three modes of perception. First, the kama, we feel something. Then, the astral, we see the form of it. And lastly, the manasic, we capture the idea. So we think using those, feeling to form to idea, we can disagree with what you said about just anyone picking this up. We think if they speak English and they might begin with feeling something about this and move gradually through it, the book changes you.
We hope so, because we do it almost every year. For 9 months out of the year, so yes.
Well, that's the period of gestation, so I'm not.
It's true.
But the rest of the year is very fruitful.
Yes.
So this entire subject this evening is about the astral and astral doubles and apparitions. There used to be a lot of, well, I think there probably still is on television, there's a lot of programs that use this, you know, ghost hunter. But it's more sensationalism than anything else. But the fact that if we have moments when we envision something, is that our imagination? Is that an inner projection of that idea on the brain, that's from our memory or from something?
When we envision something, is that coming from within ourselves or from without? Are these, well, we're always susceptible to the thoughts of others, their thoughts and actions. They stimulate ideas and thinkings and reactions, and hopefully will be, you know, appropriate. And imagination is something that, you know, we get ideas, we get a flash. It was mentioned earlier about a light bulb going off, a flash of inspiration. It's all there in the astral. It's all, you know, there's a higher... The highest form of the astral is the Akashic, where all the records are. That's why if all the if all these books were burnt, these ideas would they still exist. So it goes beyond, you know, there is a record, and there are keepers of the record, and these ideas have been periodically withdrawn and then reintroduced. And so it's all in the astral. Every thought, action, all images. It's all there.
So we really don't know when we see something, whether we're seeing it and somebody else could see it, or it's coming from within ourselves, or our astral senses. We don't know, do we?
Not really. And we only see the ideal forms. In a sense, we see ideal forms. We don't see the actual form. And forms change over time through evolution. And every form that ever existed, including all the extinct animals, of which there's been many in the last century, they still exist there in ideal form. Yes?
But because as thinkers, we're all collectively operating on the same plane or state of consciousness, there's certain perception, certain faculty of perception, that is common to us all. So we can all look at the same object, and by discussing it with one another, be sure that it's a ball or it's a cube, because we're all in the same state of perception.
Right.
Now, maybe the shade of color, or there might be some minor variations depending on our individual stimuli, but we're all working together on this plane and state. If we were in a sleep state or a dream state, we would not see what everybody else could see.
Right, so there's the waking, the dreaming, and the deep sleep state, and we're and the after death states, we're always operating on some state, and there's consensus in a sense there's convention, we've come to a consensus that this is a desk or a table. Maybe we don't know, which is it, a desk or a table? But there needs to be conventions. We need to operate from certain premises. Well, we have exhausted the hour. If anyone wants to volunteer for the part for next week, you can let the person at the book table know, and the meeting is adjourned.